Good evening and welcome to this Friday extended edition of the KRFP Evening Report. On today's show, we'll hear from the book launch event for Leontina Hormel's Trailer Park America book, which tells the story of all of the residents of the Syringa mobile home community east of Moscow losing their homes. But first, world headlines from FSN, followed by a roundup of regional news.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Benji Hire. The entire UN humanitarian operation in Gaza is on the brink of collapse, according to officials briefing the United Nations General Assembly. With the latest, Jody Jacobs from the UN headquarters in New York.
The United Nations has once again called for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. The organization says the killings and the humanitarian needs have become intolerable. UNRWA's Natalie Butcher says this has become, quote, mission impossible.
We cannot reach people in need, including thousands still trapped in the north. We cannot provide sufficient assistance to those we can reach.
The briefing at the UN General Assembly comes as aid deliveries in Gaza were suspended on Friday due to shortages of fuel and a communications blackout. The United Nations World Food Programme says given the situation on the ground, civilians face the immediate possibility of starvation. The WHO says the health system is near collapse.
Israel's war cabinet announced it will allow two fuel trucks into the Gaza Strip each day for the UN to continue aid work. Meanwhile, Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has called on Israel to end its military operation against Hamas and is also demanding an immediate ceasefire be signed. He made those comments during a news conference with German Chancellor Olaf Scholz, who insisted his country would never compromise on Israel's right to exist and to defend itself. Trent Murray's in Berlin.
There's been significant build-up to this visit by President Erdogan, with the German and Turkish governments expressing very different views to the war between Israel and Hamas. Erdogan has labelled Israel a, quote, terror state, and said it should be investigated for war crimes following its invasion of Gaza. He also said Hamas were not terrorists, but instead warriors fighting to protect their lands.
In the US, President Joe Biden signed a stopgap spending bill averting a shutdown. It keeps the government funded for now. In Washington, Nick Harper reports.
President Biden's signature comes after the House and then the Senate swiftly passed the measure this week. The short-term bill was proposed by new House Speaker Mike Johnson and will fund four federal agencies until January the 19th and the remaining until February the 2nd, at which point new funding measures will need to be agreed upon to again try and prevent a government shutdown. Biden signed the bill on the sidelines of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit in San Francisco, where he's meeting Pacific Rim nations.
And the White House has criticised tech billionaire Elon Musk for endorsing an anti-Semitic social media post on his site X, formerly Twitter. He replied to an anti-Jewish trope with the words, "the absolute truth." Anti-Semitism has been on the rise stateside since the war between Israel and Hamas. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. Idaho Secretary of State Phil McGrain says his office cannot enforce the state Republican Party's new rule preventing people from voting in Republican primaries if they do not officially affiliate with the party before December 30th. McGrain said his office must follow Idaho law, which sets the deadlines for changing party affiliation at 67 days before the primary elections. That would mean the deadline for affiliation to vote in next year's May Republican primary would be March 15th, which is also the deadline for candidates to file their candidacy declarations. The legislature removed the March presidential primary from Idaho's election calendar last year, so both the Idaho Republican and Democratic parties will hold caucuses for their presidential selections in March. The May primary is for all the other races on the ballot. The Idaho Capital Sun reported McGrain wrote in a letter to Idaho Republican Party Chair Dorothy Moon of Stanley yesterday, quote, We merely assert that the executive branch cannot act on these rules without legislative action. As a former member of the Idaho legislature, I am sure that you agree that the decision of whether a change to our election law is warranted is a decision best left to the legislature, since they were elected by the people of Idaho to make those decisions. After reviewing the law and consulting with the Attorney General's office, we have determined that your request is outside of my authority as Secretary of State. As an executive branch official, I am tasked with administering Idaho law as provided by the Idaho legislature. Democrats allow any voter to participate in their primaries in Idaho, but all voters are restricted from voting in two different parties' primary ballots on the same election day. The Idaho Republican Party is attempting to impose purity tests for voting in primaries in hopes of maintaining a right-wing stranglehold on party politics that they have gained in the past 2 years. And part of that is when the state party's leadership voted over the summer to adopt new rules. One is that any voter must affiliate with the Idaho Republican Party by December 30th to vote in next year's Idaho Republican Party primary election. The other major new rule impacting primary voting is that any voter who changes their political party affiliation from a different political party to the Idaho Republican Party must wait 1 year after December 30th in the year they unaffiliated from the old political party to affiliate with the Idaho Republican Party. West Ada school board members have banned a book from school libraries in the district that indicts rape culture from the point of view of teenage girls. The school board voted unanimously to reverse a decision by the district's book reconsideration committee, which had found the book aligned with the West Ada School District's book selection criteria. According to the Idaho Education News, some trustees said the book The Nowhere Girls by Amy Reed has too much sexual content to allow for access to the book without parental oversight. Other trustees said the book wrongfully teaches that seeking revenge is the correct response to sexual assault. The book's publisher, Simon & Schuster, says the young adult genre book tells the tale of three misfit teens who avenge the rape of a fellow classmate and, quote, trigger a change in the misogynist culture of their high school. School district patron Renee McSherry asked the school's reconsideration board to take the book out of district libraries. McSherry called the book vulgar and obscene. She wrote, "I would not recommend this book to anyone, especially minors, who we are trying to help achieve academic excellence and to become virtuous citizens in society." When voting to ban the book, school board vice chair Renee Osuna said, "As powerful as the storyline is, there are too many sections that aren't age appropriate for a 13-year-old student." The Washington State University Board of Regents has an informational item on its agenda for its 2-day meeting in Vancouver, which takes place yesterday and today, with a proposal to raise tuition by 3% next year. Tuition currently makes up 39% of WSU's allocable dollars. The Daily News reports Washington State University Chief Financial Officer Leslie Brunelli said 81% of the school's gross tuition revenue comes from undergraduates, and 75% of that comes from in-state students. Brunelli said tuition revenue will likely decrease by $3.2 million if the university does not increase tuition. Inflation and enrollment declines have caused WSU to make budget reductions in the last 2 years. Brunelli said tuition mostly pays for salaries, and the state has allocated only 66% of what's needed for faculty raises. This year's July 1st raise for classified staff at WSU was 4%, but Brunelli said if the school only used state dollars for the raise, they would have been only 2.3%. WSU officials anticipate giving a 3% raise to classified staff next year, but without the university adding money on top of state funding, the raises will only be 1.6%. Idaho Senator Pro Tem Chuck Winder of Boise has told fellow Republican Senator Brian Lenny of Nampa he has removed him as vice chair of the Senate Commerce and Human Resources Committee. Winder wrote in a letter to Lenny, the action is in response to his conduct as vice chair of the committee, in which Winder alleged Lenny had, quote, aggressively attacked, disparaged, and degraded fellow members of the Senate, members of Senate leadership, and members of the general public. Earlier this week, Winder sent similar letters to Senator and Health and Welfare Vice Chair Glenda Zwiederveld of Twin Falls and Scott Herndon of Sagal, both who are members of the Idaho Freedom Caucus, which is the right wing of the legislature. Senator Winder asked Senators Herndon and Zwiederveld to apologize to their fellow Senate members and members of the Budget Writing Committee. According to the Idaho Capital Sun, Zwiederveld responded in a Substack post, regardless of what actions the leadership takes, I do not work for them. I work for you, the people. I will not allow intimidation to silence me. Zwiederveld said she will use her new free time to read up on more bills, research budget requests, and concentrate on her own legislation. Herndon said, in my opinion, better government comes from healthy debate, and Senator Winder is trying to quash debate. A recent Centers for Disease Control report says Idaho's vaccine exemption rate is the highest in the nation at 12.1%. That greatly outflanks Oregon and Utah, which have 8.2% and 8.1% rates, respectively. There are seven states with exemption rates between 5 and 8%. St. Alphonsus Regional Medical Center pediatrician Dr. Michael Wheaton told Boise television station KTVB a 5% or higher exemption rate could increase risks of disease outbreaks from polio and measles. Wheaton said a 5% increase in measles vaccination opt-outs would place a greater strain on the healthcare system in the state. Wheaton said, just this year, measles came back to the state of Idaho from an individual who went to another country where there was an outbreak. He was not vaccinated. He came back, and we had 10 cases of measles. We saw it with the pandemic as we were trying to figure out the burden of COVID on our population. The same thing will eventually occur if less and less people vaccinate against diseases such as measles. Wheaton said the report reflects a growing public concern of the medical industry in general. According to the report, pre-pandemic exemption rates were within the recommended 5% guideline. However, during and after the pandemic, that number began going up. Wheaton said, I do think the pandemic really brought out some things that we didn't anticipate. I think we had information overload to the public, and I think there was a greater spread of misinformation. Wheaton said doctors and the state are working hard to improve vaccination rates. He said the state of Idaho is very unique because of our immunization rates. We've opened that program up to all children, so there really are no vaccine costs. Wheaton said there is an issue of how easily parents can obtain vaccine exemptions in Idaho. He said a parent can get an exemption just by filling out the appropriate forms and returning them to schools or child care centers. Nationally, only 7% of all adults and 2% of all children have received the newest updated COVID vaccine, despite a public undertaking similar to the annual influenza campaign. Harvard Medical School Clinical Director of Transplant and Immunocompromised Host Infectious Diseases at the Massachusetts General Hospital, Dr. Camille Cotton, said the exemption numbers are abysmal. Cotton said some of the problem may be patient confusion. She recommends increased education efforts for the public. According to the Centers for Disease Control, the number of COVID cases is relatively low right now compared to the early months of the pandemic, but there are still 18,000 hospitalizations and 12,000 deaths from COVID every week in the U.S. You're tuned in to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored by the Moscow Food Co-op, specializing in food, goods, and programs that nourish and nurture our community. The Moscow Food Co-op is located at 121 East 5th Street. For more information, visit moscowfood.coop, call 882-8537, or find them on Facebook.
Spokane Police Chief Craig Meidel has announced he will resign at the end of the year. It is one of a number of resignations in city government since current Mayor Nadine Woodward lost her re-election bid to Lisa Brown. When then-Mayor David Condon appointed Meidel as police chief in 2016, he was controversial because of his participation in a courtroom group salute by Spokane police officers as Officer Carl Thompson was led out of the courtroom by bailiffs in handcuffs following his conviction for civil rights violations against citizen Otto Zem, who Thompson apparently killed by putting him in a chokehold in a convenience store in 2006. Meidel apologized for the salute and won over some of his critics by bringing relative stability to the department after Condon fired Police Chief Frank Straub in 2015 for sexual harassment and creating a hostile work environment. Recently, activists have called for Meidel's resignation because they say he inappropriately shared information with local business owners, including Chud Wendell, who owns the Fox Theater and the Bing Crosby Theater, and who is active in local politics and openly critical of the more liberal members of the city council. The city council in March voted to allow the city's police ombudsman to investigate the claims after Mayor Nadine Woodward refused to move forward with an investigation. Police have killed a number of community members under Meidel's tenure, and the city reached a $4 million settlement last year with the family of David Novak, who Spokane police killed in 2019. Mayor-elect Lisa Brown has not yet decided on the process for hiring Meidel's replacement. National Park Service officials say they have confirmed the first case of chronic wasting disease in mule deer in Yellowstone National Park. The disease, caused by a misfolded prion protein, is 100% fatal in white-tailed deer, mule deer, elk, and moose. Deer, elk, and moose shed the disease through saliva, urine, feces, blood, and antler velvet, and the prions can last in the environment for decades. The Park Service estimates that 10% to 15% of the mule deer who live near Cody, Wyoming, and migrate into the southeastern part of Yellowstone Park have chronic wasting disease. Park Service spokesperson Morgan Worthen said the agency will revise its chronic wasting disease surveillance plan and will finish the revisions by next year. Montana wildlife officials report they tested 2,400 animals for chronic wasting disease and 3.5%, all of them white-tailed deer and mule deer, had chronic wasting disease.
Workers at Legacy's Women's Health Clinics have announced their intention to unionize. About 60 nurse midwives and other health staff at clinics in Oregon and Southwest Washington intend to join the Oregon Nurses Association. Heather Webster is a certified nurse midwife at Legacy Emanuel Medical Center in North Portland. She says the decision was driven in part by the failed attempt to close the birth center at Legacy Mount Hood Medical Center in Gresham.
There's a lot of stakeholders in this that were never consulted about that change and how it would affect their jobs. And so it became really obvious that we really needed a seat at the table and to be able to have negotiations around things like this and be able to be heard when we had concerns.
In response to the drive, Legacy Health said it respects an employee's right to choose whether to be represented by a union and will respect the outcome of any petition to unionize. Staff involved in the union drive are hoping to get approval from the National Labor Relations Board for a vote by the end of the year. Infant and maternal health are major issues in the U.S. A recent study found the infant mortality rate rose between 2021 and 2022 for the first time in two decades. Webster says midwives are key to infant care.
The truth is, midwives are really the answer to the morbidity and mortality rate of moms and babies in the U.S. And it's been proven time and time again. Midwives decrease cesarean birth rates. Midwives decrease preterm birth rates.
Webster says midwives face a number of issues, including difficulty finding coverage when they're sick and burnout.
The demands are great, and the pay isn't always that great. And so we really have to bring our standards up, and that is so the people inheriting this profession will stay in it and make it worth their while.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
KRFP thanks its listeners and supporters, including the Palouse Folklore Society, celebrating traditional music and dance on the Palouse since 1982. The Palouse Folklore Society sponsors concerts, jam sessions, and a monthly contra dance. Find out more at palousefolk.org or on Facebook.
We now turn to our featured segment. University of Idaho sociology professor Leontina Hormel held a launch event Tuesday night at the 1912 Center for her new book, Trailer Park America, Reimagining Working Class Communities. Hormel's book documents the decline and closure of the Syringa Mobile Home Park east of Moscow, which was started in 1960 with federal subsidies for starting working-class communities. When Syringa and other similar mobile home parks started in the early 1960s, most of them were on the edges of community. The royalties from Leontina Hormel's book, Trailer Park America, will go to the local organization that tackles homelessness situations and housing insecurity, Sojourners Alliance. The presentation Tuesday started with Syringa Mobile Home Park resident Don Tatchell, who wrote the foreword to the book, giving a brief presentation.
I would like to introduce the author of the foreword to Trailer Park America, U.S. military veteran, Syringa community activist, grassroots organizer, and UY alumna, Don Tatchell.
Well, if I start to stammer, please forgive me. This is kind of emotional. This has been a heck of a 10 years for me, and I'm a little nervous and I'm a little scared, and I may stammer a little bit because I have a little stuttering problem when I get nervous. But I'm Don Tatchell. I'm the grassroots organizer, writer, collaborator, and I wanted to make a change for the people and what we experienced. When I came home many years ago, I started a dream that wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for family and the community support. My words sometimes fall short, and people over the years have mistakenly misunderstood my voice of reason. They didn't see the whole person standing in front of you today. It is truly humbling, and it's also scary at the same time. Judgments are placed on individuals like me in communities that face what we faced in the community during this time in Syringa. I had many conversations upon returning with my brother Chris so many years ago. One evening, shortly before his death, we had a conversation on how he saw the park. In that conversation, he asked me to stand and to be brave, and that's what I'm doing tonight. I chose to honor his conversation with this book to become a reality. He saw the park as a place that people could heal and to be themselves if given an honest and fair shot at what they were going through in their lives. He worked many long hours, and yes, his budget was tight by McGar. I personally dug ditches, cleaned trailers, and much, much more with my brother when I first arrived back in 2000. The park was a place that I could heal and that I was protected by a community that knew the hardships. The park was a community of hope and love and a connection to the outside world when needed. The only way that I could express his wish was to ask for help. When I went searching and looking for help, I needed someone to witness what was going through and express the voices of the people. Hormel came to mind. I needed a third-person perspective that would do the park justice. When I was a student in Hormel sociology class at the University of Idaho back in 2004, 2005, well, I was there for a long time, let's just say, Hormel was a perfect fit to help in the perspective and to tell her perspective of the community. This is what the people needed so we could be heard. No one would listen to the community at all. We didn't have a voice, and when we did, it wasn't heard. The community reached out and used what we knew at the time. The book was needed to happen to all to hear the people's point of view and to help provide some key perspectives if this was to happen again. These pages hold real life experience and what we faced as a community. These pages bring a comprehensive perspective of the good times, the bad times, and the experience of the Syringa community as a whole. Many people question what was going on. We all did at one point. These pages are voices of the community and what could not be heard at the time. Now our voices are on these pages, and we can heal from the deep wound that we all faced as a community. We need to come together as a community and build from what we've learned. We all might have something in common, and that might be the love for our community, whether it's passing through or just staying for a while or living here for generations. We all share this land, and we all love this land. If we didn't, why are we here tonight? I had to make a commitment to myself to be brave enough to stand and to face the problems that we were facing in the community. I asked myself what my brother would do and how I would do it with a positive action for all. I'm asking this community, what is it going to take to create a stepping stone so what happened to my community, Syringa, won't happen again? The turning edge is when times are hard within the soul of life. Culture turns on the means that drives the lower class to the edge of inhabitable land. Local systems that are there to help. Place never-ending forms in front of you. Sometimes it takes weeks or months to tap into the resources, which will bring you to your knees in tears. Some will break and fall, while others will fall into a tumble on a wheel that only cycles the physical behaviors that will keep it on a level of low income. With no way out for those who struggle on the turning, burning edge we call life, stability of one's income will turn the edge to the struggling edge. Only a few will see the edge who can change the edge to their advantage. That edge is the internal acceptance of other economic standards of that class only. The individual proceeds to push the heart and the soul to the brink of the unknown, scared and afraid of the new, turning, burning edge of the unknown. Everything you knew is now wrong. Life is wrong, and the flames burn deep. The people around you do not know the confusion, the frustration that is seen through the eyes of the turning, burning edge. Friends and family becomes examples of what not to do. Only you can choose a direction of new growth or the edge of life. The flame burns and hope is lost. New networks, foundations, build the unknown, new guidelines. Struggles of the old cut deep in the mind. Nothing works. You feel broke, and yet you are not. Economically, you are strapped, and your bark becomes soft and weak. You stumble, you fall. You catch yourself falling into the emptiness of the void that was once filled with love, hopes, and dreams. You stammer, yet you step on the turning, burning edge for the better. After time, you begin to rise. The inner steps of new guidelines set forth by others who now see you on a level of the turning, burning edge of a wheel that spins on others' opinions and their self-worth. I wrote that in the midst of everything that was going on in Seringa Trailer Park. That's what we were feeling, and we were in agonizing, and there was nothing. Just when the book came out a couple of weeks ago, when it came out on the 10th, 4 days ago, I was going on what I was going to say tonight. And express, you know, myself. And I came upon these words. Roads we travel are far and wide to the ever-reaching skies. The travel roads leads ever-weaving, twisting to the unknown. Some lead to the sun and warmth of days to come. Some lead to the dark and narrow of the death of days gone by. Memories made by roads we travel, ever reaching for the sun and for the sky. Days of old twisted and torn by the thorn of a rose. Sunrises, sunsets, ever twisted by the corners of the unknown. We travel, reaching for the sky. Days come, days go, we travel to the unknown. Hang on tight and wander the road, for it will shine over the rise. Travel long, travel wide, to the unknown actions of the skies. That came to me when this book came out. It's been 10 years and a long road of struggle and hardship. Within these pages, that Hormel, she was a turnkey for the community, and I couldn't have done it without her. I, over the years, have thought of myself as the voice of the voiceless, because I'm standing here telling you and showing you the pain and the struggles that happened in these pages. So with that, I want to turn it over to LT. And Seringa is still with us. It's still outside. And it's gotten worse over the years. Again, I'm asking, what can we do as a community to come together to help bridge so it won't happen again in our community? Okay.
Okay, well,
need to gather my thoughts here for 2 moments. All right. The year 2013, 6 families bought homes in Syringa Mobile Home Park with exactly the kinds of dreams and hopes that Dawn had when she moved there in the early 2000s. They were a total of 25 individuals, parents with children with special needs, who knew that at least they had a bus that would stop at the mobile home community, bring their children safely out there. And all the while, they had an inexpensive home that they were purchasing, and they only had to pay $260 a month for the land. And I just want to give perspective. Right now, there are mobile home communities that are being told that they need to pay at minimum $525 a month for land. That is how much things have changed since 2013 in this community. December 18th, 2013, that same year, Idaho DEQ found coliform bacteria in the drinking water after weeks and weeks of complaints coming from Syringa Mobile Home Park. And if, for those who don't know what coliform bacteria is, it's from fecal matter entering into the water system. So it was a result of sewage contamination. January 2014, Idaho DEQ slammed, I'm just going to use that word, it's not technical and legal jargon, but slammed Magar Imagar, the park owner, with a lawsuit for violating many laws for protecting drinking water quality and also the way the sewage system was turning bad. And then in February 2014, thanks to several residents forming an alliance with the UI Legal Aid Clinic, Maureen Laughlin is here tonight, who was part of that, they issued a class action lawsuit to at least make sure that this water got turned on, because when that fecal matter was detected in the water system on December 18th, 2013, the residents of Syringa Mobile Home Park would have their water shut off for 93 days in one of the coldest winters we've had on record over the past decade. Right? Yes. By December, it had dropped to about 8 degrees on a couple of the nights, and this was right before their water was turned off. It was a very harsh winter. This photograph, which is part of the cover of the book, was donated to me, by the way, from Lewiston Tribune, and it was taken right before Valentine's Day, at the time that these lawsuits were being filed. And it was also when all the water was shut off. So it was, I really am grateful to local news media for enabling me to tell part of this story with Dawn tonight. Next slide. So how did I get involved in this project? Well, part of the story of the book is about how lower-income working-class people who live in mobile home communities, but also in other places in a community that are considered not the best places, how they end up being stigmatized. And I somehow learned in fall of 2009 in an intro to sociology class that one of my students, who's right here tonight, Don Tatchell, lived in Syringa Mobile Home Park. I also had another student who was an ROTC cadet who was also living in Syringa Mobile Home Park with her husband and child. So I already felt like Syringa meant something. Plus, if anyone knows where Syringa is located, which will be in a slide in a moment, it's a gorgeous location, and a lot of us bike and run and take leisurely little Sunday drives out there all the time. It's a gorgeous location. So I knew about it in that way, too. So when I was following the news when this happened in 2013 into 2014, I was following it knowing that there were people that I cared a lot about in that community. And I also know from sociology that I care a lot about people who live in the margins, which is what Syringa really symbolized to me. But we had UI Legal Aid Clinic on it, and I was like, yeah, they're getting their time there. And we had Idaho DEQ getting them in the other direction. Plus, there had been a lawsuit from Idaho Conservation League a few years earlier in 2012, which the court ruled in favor of the complainant there that said, yes, indeed, the sewage contamination that's leaking into the South Fork of the Palouse River, that's pretty bad too. So Magari and Magar was on the hook for three different lawsuits, so I was certain that justice was going to be served. And yet a year passed. After delay upon delay, we got to a point in March 2015 where the news was telling us not only is Magar not really sticking to his part of the bargain, but he was threatening to close the park at this time as well. November 2014, he made little threats, right, Maureen? And also in March, when he saw that the courts were indeed saying he owed money to the residents and that they had been abused by his neglect. So once I saw those headlines, I reached out, and Don reached out, and we got together. And I also got together with the other student and sat down and asked, what can we do? And so it was when we met that I committed to being an observer, to lay witness to what was happening to the residents themselves, and to try to figure out ways to make sure that their experiences were broadcast in whichever way possible. I never knew that I was going to start turning into a mobile home community advocate for a long time. I'm pretty committed now. Next. So, for those of you who may be new to Syringa Mobile Home Park and where it might be, this is a map. It's probably kind of hard to see, but you might be able to at least read Syringa MHP there. It's right along Robinson Park Road. You drive out of town past where it used to be the Slurp and Burp. I think it's a daycare center now. I wish it were the Slurpum still, though, because it just seems so Moscow, Idaho to me. But,
Slurp and Burp, six-pack to go.
Yeah, right. But it's out there in that beautiful spot with a million-dollar view of Moscow Mountain and the beautiful four-season experience. When I was writing this book, I wanted to do more than simply talk about the case, because sociologists and historians firmly believe that you need to go way back in history, right, Brianne Pilgrim? To really think about, I also have another sociologist here, Laura Earls from LCSC. You have to be historical about how is it that Syringa ended up here? How is it that it was considered a marginalized space? Because it's a beautiful location, right? Beautiful. So how did it end up becoming this? The history here, where it's located, Haskins Flat. I learned that. I never knew that that beautiful meadow that you dip into and then take that sharp right-hand turn that then launches you further east toward Robinson Park, that meadow is actually called Haskins Flat by the old-timers. And Haskins Flat was the last place where people, locals, were able to see women, Nimiipuu women, come up and harvest what was left of the camas up here on the Palouse. So what happened is that Seringa Mobile Home Park was actually built on top of a seasonally moist wetland, which is very dynamic, gets very, very wet in the wet seasons, and then it dries out. So part of what I learned in thinking about this through Shannon Music, who said, look, I think there's a spring that flows into the sewage lagoons. And I talked with another crew, with the Latah County Historical Society, another group of folks who said, yeah, I think actually they built that in the wrong place because that has springs and it probably would have been a pond back before it was developed. So it's this history that I look at to begin with to talk about how it is that we have lost sight of what these places actually are by plowing under the native landscape that the Nimiipuu and other tribes, such as the Palouse tribe and the Coeur d'Alene, that they had learned over thousands of years. And they would have been able to tell Clancy Olson, the developer, the farmer, you might not want to build a sewage lagoon right on top of a bunch of springs, because that was part of the problem, right? So I go into that history in chapter one.
And you're listening to the book launch event for Leontina Hormel's book, Trailer Park America, Reimagining Working Class Communities. The book documents the decline and closure of the Seringa Mobile Home Park east of Moscow, which was started in the 1960s. We'll be back in a moment.
Tune into Live on KEXP, exclusive live performances recorded in the shadow of the Space Needle. On the show next time, it's the new motoric psych pop of Seattle's own Spirit Award. It's one-of-a-kind sessions from your favorite artists and from a few you're about to discover. From our studios in Seattle, it's Live on KEXP.
Coming up Saturday at 3 p.m.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored by Hotchins Drug and Hobby of 307 South Main Street in Moscow. Hotchins features a pharmacy, educational toys, and hobbies. Hotchins also sells and services hearing aids. You can call Hotchins at 208-882-5536.
And we now return to our featured segment on the KRFP Evening Report here on KRFP Moscow Pullman. It's the book launch event held by University of Idaho sociology professor Leontina Hormel. The book is called Trailer Park America, Reimagining Working Class Communities. And all royalties for the book go to Sojourners Alliance.
And so many of the people that decided to do these mobile home communities with these working class community development loans, et cetera, they were still nonetheless trying to avoid all of the codes that would be up to the public safety standards of the time. So while on the one hand, yes, this was beautiful as a working class utopia, on the other hand, it was also open to a lot of problems that would arise later on. In other words, I would say Magar e Magar was definitely the worst in terms of absentee landlord behavior. On the other hand, he did buy something that was already a problem. And I do point that out in the book. And I'm actually going to talk about one story. I want you to meet Paul and Bonnie Miles, who lived in the park as retirees. They were among the oldest in the park who lived there as a couple. And I just want to share part of their story. When I interviewed Paul and Bonnie, Paul went right into a story of how he met Bonnie in the early 70s when there still was a train depot in town. And his friend would come in on the train from Spokane, and Bonnie happened to work at the train depot. So his friend was like, wow, my friend Paul should meet this really hot young woman, Bonnie. So one evening, his friend said, you know, instead of going out to the bar, why don't we go and have a late night breakfast? I have someone you should meet. And so he was sitting with his buddy at the table, and in came Bonnie, who was looking like, he said, he looked like a hippie. In fact, this is what he said. So, okay, in walked this girl, long hippie coat on crutches. And I thought, oh God, what is this? That was Paul's words. So that was their story, and they ended up having a date. He got the bravery to follow her to her car and ask her out on a date that same night. And so here I'll go into this story that I share. Bonnie and Paul married in 1973. They moved to Sagal, Idaho, and Paul commuted to Sandpoint, Idaho, where he worked as a news reporter and radio DJ. After 13 years of marriage, Bonnie and Paul planned to move somewhere where they could eventually afford to retire. Bonnie had a chunk of money she had inherited from her parents that helped the couple cover the cost of purchasing a double-wide home for $25,000. Costing only $100 a month to lease the land at the time, Syringa Mobile Home Park seemed the perfect place to retire and live off their fixed incomes from Paul's military service and the Social Security payments representing their many years of work. The park had been around since the 1960s and had a good reputation. Living there, their money could stretch a long way for a long time. Not only was this option manageable in the long term, but they managed to snag a plot for their home that was situated on the northern edge of the park, not far from where Don's home was. From this location, they could enjoy watching the colors of the famous rolling hills of the Palouse change with the seasons, from earthy brown to velvety green to harvest gold to frosted white. Just north of these hills, in full view from their backyard, stood Moscow Mountain. As Paul described it, it was premier. This was the premier trailer park in the whole area. Had a swimming pool, a recreation room, play area for the kids. It was great. Water, I mean, their water lines were all pristine. You had to do your own lawn, and they insisted that you keep them short. Syringa provided a place for the couple to enjoy the fruits of their labor. As Bonnie remarked here, they enjoyed peace and quiet. It's a lot in the country. So that was Bonnie and Paul's story. And a lot of what gets lost if we don't look at the history of place, right, is to understand that Syringa, when I talked with people like Dave McGraw, county commissioner, right, he talked about remembering Syringa back when you could go and have pool parties, you know, and all that. It was a nice place. And Bob Bonzel called it a country club when he moved there in the 80s. All right. So that changed in the early 90s. In fact, in 1992, the first complaints of Giardia show up in the records. So that was as early as 1992. But I want to point out that these problems were bubbling beneath the surface, not trying to use any puns here, but there were troubles that were indicated as early as 1971. When I was leafing through and snooping around in the Idaho DEQ boxes, I love doing that stuff, I found that in 1971 that the agency that existed that preceded Idaho DEQ, an engineer had already filed a complaint with the owner about a sewage line that was way too close to an existing well, the infamous well number 3. And it comes up again during this Giardia case. In other words, that well was not dealt with. It wasn't closed off, and the sewage lines were not changed. And when I read the records, I actually found a cassette tape that I digitized so I could listen to one of these Giardia meetings with the engineers and the park manager at the time. And they said, yeah, Clancy just doesn't want to talk about how he set up the lines. He gets really cranky. So, again, like, he knew that there were things going on, but, you know, the way that county governance happens, it's really difficult to regulate. Idaho DEQ, right, depends on voluntary compliance. So there is really very little in enforcement in that area as well. So it was easy to defer these things. So in the 80s, so there had been water scarcity. People who I interviewed in the late 70s said that they were told by managers to not water their lawns from time to time and to make sure they didn't drink too much water or take long showers. And by the 80s, the engineers learned that it was common for managers of the park to just simply shut the well system down each night and then turn it back on. Does anyone know what the problem is? Is if you turn off an entire well system, what happens? Backflow. So it opens up the opportunity for sewage to leak into the drinking water lines. So that was documented as happening as early as the early 80s, but others suspect that it might have been something that had been practiced even before Imagar owned this place. So those are some things that I found. So what happens is that, yes, we might have individual bad owners, but we are in a legal system and a governing system where the people, even if they want to try to protect you, and I know that county commissioners and city council people will be nodding, and Maureen, even if they really want to try to protect you, there are so many things that keep you from being able to stop people from doing bad things because of private property, right? They have a lot of rights if it's on their land that they own. All right. So part of my book talks about how this is what I felt I was observing residents experiencing. And it seems as though we could say this was even going on in the 80s and 90s. I found letters where women wrote complaints to Magar in the 80s about the water and the problems of sewage way back then. And so I think of this as what environmental justice folks call slow violence, where there isn't anything in place to protect people from this steady normalization of dangerous, hazardous experiences. And so, so that's what I saw there. And then also, too, when you think about the legal system, when Magar was actually under the microscope, he had all of this power to be able to drag his feet in the process. He knew the system all too well, and once he was caught by February of 2015, and Legal Aid Clinic was about to get him to comply, he filed for bankruptcy. So a little bit of that story is shared in this book as well. The other thing that happens when you own property like Magar or other people like corporations, for instance, is that there are very few tools that the county has to try to get you to do something good for the people. So the one thing that county commissioners had to try to help was using red tags. Red tags are usually used to condemn buildings until they are brought up to code. In this case, red tags were used to keep people, once one household moved out, to keep other people from buying or renting a home that was on the premises. So they would put red tags on emptied buildings, and so it couldn't be rented. but it was also really vague what could be done with the home, right? And so that is where a lot of conflict actually took place, because for the people who lived in the park, who owned the homes that got red tagged, they felt like they had lost all of the value of their homes. Meanwhile, with all of these empty homes, people started breaking into them. There were squatters. There were people that simply tried to scavenge the materials off of these homes. People felt, if they were still living in that community, that they were steadily, slowly being surrounded by carcasses of what used to be their neighbors' homes, right? So this is where I talk a lot about this in the Red Tags chapter, in the Syringa Refugees chapter, and in Death of Community, not just about red tags, but the whole experience of people seeing all of these places that used to be inhabited by people. They may not have even liked some of these people, but they knew these people, and they kept being shed away, losing community. All right. I think this is one. Oh, there we go.
But when the sewer comes out of the ground and the water's off, you go to complain again, and yet nothing gets done. Then you call the health department, nothing gets done. Then you call the DEQ and demand that something be done. They might show up, they might call the owner, but as far as they're concerned, he's compliant. There's nothing they can do.
I moved out here, one, because it was the only place that was available that would take me and my animals. Mm-hmm. And secondly, it was out in the country. You know, it's... I enjoy just being a little bit out there, you know. I don't mean mentally, I just mean... Well, there's not so much crowd. So I came out here with the animals, the family, and it was really relaxing.
In 1984, a man named Magar E. Magar, despite the fact that he was already well known in Oregon and Washington for his poor management of mobile home parks, was allowed to purchase a thriving Syringa mobile home park. In the 1990s, he was sued by a law clinic in Lewis and Clark University over poor management of a park outside of Portland, Oregon. In this case, Magar's poor management ultimately caused raw sewage from the park to leak into the Columbia River. When he was sued, Mr. Magar filed for bankruptcy and sold the park. Meanwhile, in Syringa, he continued his trend of poor management. Among other things, Mr. Magar neglected to do maintenance that was needed on the roads, the rec center, and of course, the water system. The water would often go out, contaminants were often found in the water, and the sewage lagoon would overflow. In late 2013, the legal aid clinic at the University of Idaho began to receive phone calls from residents in the park. This was after over 2 weeks without having drinking water. This prompted the clinic to file a class action lawsuit over the water on February 26, 2014. Once they filed, the legal aid clinic discovered that Mr. Magar was already being sued by the Idaho Conservation League and the Department of Environmental Quality over his management of the park. It took over 3 years for the team to reach a settlement in November 2017 with Mr. Magar's daughter, Shelley, who is the current owner of Syringa Mobile Home Park. As part of the settlement, residents will receive a small compensation over everything they endured due to a man with an extensive history of mismanagement. Because Syringa Mobile Home Park resides outside of city limits, jurisdiction of the park put county officials at the forefront of the decisions at the park in legal terms. With that, red tags were implemented. Red tags were initially introduced in 2014 as a way to isolate exposure to the water. Some suppose that the county commissioners also used this as a form to squeeze Magar financially in order to push for leverage and action. Unfortunately, this decision has also had side effects that worsen the financial and upward mobility of homeowners at the park. The red tags have been mistaken as condemnation notices, making it a scavenging hotspot. Bed skirting has been stolen from the trailers to be sold for money, as has the copper wiring in the walls. In addition, many of the trailers have been broken into. As a result of red tags, after residents vacated their homes, nobody was allowed to move in after them. This inevitably cost some of the residents their upward mobility, as over 50% of the mobile homes are privately owned, while the land it is on belongs to Magar. Red tags have also caused the home values to decrease by 80% since 2012. The cost to remove a mobile home is estimated at $6,000, not including preparation for the movement and installment of the mobile home in a different park.
You're that group that showed up from the trailer park, and it wasn't a good thing. So at one point in history, you would say, oh, wow, my kid gets to go to Syringa and swim in the pool or go hang out with their buddies. And now it's like, I'm not so sure I want you to go out there, you know.
The sentiment that many residents share is that living at Syringa comes with a certain stigma. They believe that this stigma has led community members to treat them differently based on their relationship to Syringa.
And I have spent so much time on the phone, you know, trying to find movers, trying to find lots. And, I mean, it's once a month. I will call the trailer courts. I will call every trailer court in this town. Mm-hmm. Say, hey, you got a double lot? No, we ain't got any. Or you get, when you call, and you're giving them the specifics, and it's, oh, well, you're one of those people.
And that's coming from other parks.
Yeah. And it's like, oh, okay. No, really, I'm not one of those people.
I've heard others complain about that.
Yeah. And it's like,
that the address comes with a...
That's exactly. Instant label. You know, and it's like, yes, I live out there, but I don't deserve to be broke down into a different category. Mm-hmm. You know, and I've definitely noticed with a lot of them, and all you have to do is say Syringa, and the conversation's done. You know, they don't want to listen, they don't want to, it's just, oh, well, you're from Syringa, so we're done. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're listening to the book launch event Tuesday night at the 1912 Center, University of Idaho sociology professor Leontina Hormel's book, Trailer Park America, Reimagining Working Class Communities. And this is the KRFP Evening Report on KRFP Moscow Pullman. We'll continue with the book launch event in just a moment. Upcoming, we will hear some discussion about the recent purchase of six of Moscow's larger mobile home parks by the investment firm Hurst & Son during the last 2 years, with the ensuing rent increases, new leases, and list of rules and fines.
KRFP thanks its listeners and sponsors, including Tie-Dye Everything, with locally made tie-dyed items, incense, and other accessories. Tie-Dye Everything is located near 6th Street at 527 South Main Street in Moscow. For more information, you can find Tie-Dye Everything at tiedye-everything.com.
So, that film was created and with a lot of support from UI undergraduate student researchers. We went out, we decided that one of the ways to try to advocate for Syringa residents was to have a forum in this exact room in late January 2018, where Don, Bob Bonzel, and Jim Ware, who was in this film, spoke about their experiences, and where we tried to come together to listen to what residents needed. So that film was created to try to demonstrate at the time what things were looking like in January 2018. When park closure was announced in late September 2017, I was very lucky to have Maureen Laughlin keeping me up to date about things, and she texted me immediately when she got notice in September from Shelley Magar that indeed, after all these years of threats of closure, that the decision was made to close. And people were given, at that time, we thought that people were not going to have and more than, well, they were going to give them 6 months, which is what, thanks to Shirley Ringo's work with others in the early 2000s, 6 months' notice was given for mobile home park residents to be able to move in the case of closure. But the timing would have been people trying to move out in the wettest time from this seasonally moist wetland. So there is no way that you were going to haul out double wides and single wides with heavy equipment at that time. So thanks to the UI Legal Aid Clinic work in bankruptcy court, they were able to negotiate June 5th as the official closure time. So at least it gave about a month of somewhat drier conditions for people to try to get out. Amy Pace, who is the person interviewed in that audio recording, she had a double wide, and it was a lot of work to get it out of her spot. And it ended up careening off the gravel road once, things like that, when it was being moved in the middle of the night. Don, did you follow that, or was it Amy?
I videotaped it. It was a little over 24 hours to move her trailer. And it went off the road one time because we had to take it over on the back road. And if you know the back roads here in Moscow, the farmers, they get a little bumpy, especially during with all the big equipment and everything. And even a single wide on some of these back roads are so narrow that it's only inches. So they had to creep them all. And they got it in late at night. And thanks to the trailer park owner that let her in, once they got it in, it was still a couple of days before they could get her trailer all the way put back together again. Because if you don't know, a double wide comes in two pieces and you have to build the roof on top of it to actually bridge it and seal it. And it was a tedious task,
She made it. But after all of that stigma that she was also experiencing, right, many parks, and she wasn't the only homeowner. Several talked about seeing empty places in several of the local parks and being told there's no vacancy here, simply from the address. And I do go into a little bit of detail in the book about that and what social psychologists call the social psychology of scorning down. Because there are no repercussions for people who are of higher status. They don't lose anything if they ignore people who are in need if they're considered lower status. And so I talk about that process as something that was sort of treated as acceptable among the different park owners in town. One of the questions that kept coming up, too, in the public, different local leaders who I'd talked with from time to time, was just the puzzle of why didn't people move out already? The writing was on the wall. Sewage lagoons were not going to get fixed. The muskrats weren't going to move away, for instance, those sorts of things. So why did people stay? And for people that were hanging out all the time out there, it was pretty obvious why, you know, and so it was hard not to be a little defensive when you'd hear that question. But it was an important question to answer by looking at what kinds of people were living out in Syringa by the time this closure was announced. And just a simple table, we had about 41 households. It could have been more than that because some people were hanging out but didn't want to be known that they were out there, those sorts of things. But of the households, I was able to follow pretty carefully through the surveys that we conducted at the UI Law School in October 9th, 2017, doing shadowing caseworkers for the Department of Health and Welfare and Family Promise of the Palouse, and also just simply like going back and visiting people, I was able to derive some of the demographic information about the people living out at the park. And I think it helped, and in fact, I know it helped me think about how the myth about trailer park dwellers and homeowners, how there's a myth about them being druggies, being criminal, all of those sorts of things, didn't necessarily hold with the people that were out there for the long haul. So in terms of criminal records, at least the ones that I was able to verify, you know, but a lot of people thought that there were a lot of criminal records, and there were certainly some, but they didn't surpass what the average would be in Moscow itself. You can assume that one in three people have probably somehow tangled with law and would have something on their criminal records. May not be super serious. We're not just talking about felonies here. But across the gamut, one in three people has an interaction with the law that can end up on your record. And less than that, 16% here in Syringa had that kind of had a criminal record. And most of them were very open that they had them, too. Then, too, about drug substance use disorders. While it's a relatively high number, now I'm trying to find that line up, 26%, that's, you know, only slightly above what the national average is. And I don't really trust Idaho averages. I don't know if that's really exactly the number, right? Because it looks really low for Idaho, but I just really suspect that's not, you know, I've done enough research in the post-Soviet Union to understand that numbers can be played with. So not calling Idaho the Soviet Union. Okay. So,
if I may.
Yeah.
The addiction number of the households with members coping with drug addiction in rehab at 26%. A lot of people don't know that those addictions were also in AA and NA 12-step programs getting over their addiction, which helped create the safe haven for them. Because if it was to sit and to happen Friendship Square, for instance, okay, and we don't have a lot of druggies sitting in Friendship Square, but where are they going to go to get healed? Where are they going to feel safe and to be accepted for trying to heal what they're trying to get over, because they know they have a problem? That's why they were so open about it. A lot of the people that are out there with the disabilities that are caretakers, we helped each other out. We were their outside support as well as their inside support. Me, personally, I'm a recovering alcoholic and drug addict. I've been drug-free for over 28 years. And who else is going to be a drug addict and an alcoholic? Somebody that's been there. And that's why Syringa Trailer Court was part of the stepping stone. And that's why we came together to help, to support, to hand, because we knew the hardships, whether you'd be a single mom, a single dad, a step parent, a drug addict, a senior that had problems that may need to have dinner brought to him every night because he can no longer cook. The people would get on and help one another to support one another. And that's why the residents so hard in Syringa, it's so hard for us because of the simple fact, where are we going to go?
Yep.
I'm sorry.
No. What wasn't so obvious in the newspapers and the ways in which people were reporting about the problems, right? We need to know about the problems. We know this in our classes that we teach in sociology, for instance. We're really good at detecting problems, but when that's all you highlight, you also miss what the community part. What is actually functioning? Why do people not want to move, not simply because they can't afford elsewhere, that's an obvious one, but this was a community for people. It did provide those networks so that people who were struggling with substance abuse, they had people, they had neighbors that they could go to when they were struggling and talk with without judgment. And in the pages, I talk about one particular young individual who will not be named, but who was struggling, and as that community started emptying out and the support networks disappeared, that person started self-destructing, and took it out on the physical body of that community, including the recreation center. The recreation center was the community hub. It was, you know, this indoor swimming pool that you saw, that had been declining because it had been left neglected and closed off. But that community room where people had birthday parties and Halloween parties and weddings and things like that, people left it alone. They could have at any time broken into that community recreation center and retrieved the water that the owner, Shelley McGar, was supposed to distribute to people one time, but instead locked up the cases in the rec center while people were going without clean water to drink. Chris and I, by the way, as a side note, found someone who had the key to that rec center when the water was turned off after closure, and we distributed those cases to everyone that was left in the community. But it was a year and a half of not being distributed. So there was a community there, and that rec center was really important to people. It symbolized that last bastion of support. So I focus on this idea of making a functional community amid disorder, and I call it in my book, you know, we always have to have a little jargon, I call it feminized communities, not because only women do nice things, because there were a lot of men doing really nice things out at Syringa as well, but the idea of caring was fundamental, and caring in places where people are poor, they share that. They share the stigma of living in the same address where people assume things about them. There are all sorts of things that people provide, both emotionally and resource-wise, that help create this caring kind of environment. And again, not everyone got along, but people had the comfort of knowing just who they were with, right? We can list all sorts of people that really enraged people from time to time and frustrated them. But they also knew that that same person would help them out in a pinch. So these are just some photos. Dawn and her mother, Cookie Grandma, did after-school programming for several children that would have otherwise been latchkey children in their homes. And instead, they were brought to the safe place. And if they did well and conducted themselves properly, in fact, learning how to treat girls nicely, if you were a boy, that was Dawn's job. She was in the military, right? She knows how to do this. Discipline. Yep.
Natural resources for their STEM outreach.
Yep.
Outreach programs. I used a lot of the University of Idaho's MOS educational tools to help instruct, to bring nature into the children because of the situation that they were in. They could always come out to my place after they got off work. They'd do their homework, check in, see if there was any bullying going around, especially at school. And if they were nice and they got their grades, then my mom would give them a cookie. Not the cookie grandma.
Cookie grandma.
Years out there. And it saved, it did help the children.
Yep. And So that was going on. Nobody would have known that just driving by. Picture to the right is Shannon Music, who learned all about well systems and sewage lagoons right at the moment of crisis. She was Syringa's manager for quite some time. She had to deal with the lawsuits. She had to take on two hats of trying to defend Magar because he was her employer, right? And so she was very vulnerable to what happened to him. And at the same time, she was learning all about basic engineering. You know, she was turning into a civil engineer of sorts, right? And a water. Yeah, yeah. So, yep. So that's her to the right. I wanted to make sure there was a photograph of her because it wasn't just her job. She learned so much that people like her and Dawn and others, in the middle of the night, if they saw something going on, would get their clothes on and go out and help. Bonnie and Paul, who I introduced you to earlier, their house got flooded. They couldn't get out, and they were the eldest in the whole park. Dawn and Shannon and others got up, and they found pallets, and they surrounded the house with pallets so that they had a way to get out of their home. And I go on about some other issues because it was also a flood that could have been avoided, but the park owner and other people that showed up to do some things wouldn't listen to them and didn't learn that if you dig a trench that leads a spring water right into the park, that you might have floods. All right. So anyway, so it's a story of how stigma blinds people to the expertise that long-time living provides people in space, right? So there's this parallel universe of indigenous people's knowledges were ignored for centuries, and then on into this more present circumstance of people who were living in this park for a long time, their experiences were disregarded and their knowledge, all right? So, and then I also, a lot of people talk about, well, what's all that messy stuff? Why is there always stuff in people's plots? Well, some of that stuff is actually what people like Jim Ware work with so that they can barter and sell things, living off of $700 a month on disability, right? So he had to figure out ways to make ends meet, and that was one of his ways, is he built himself a little shop with a wood stove in it, and he would fix cars, and he would fix little engines. And that's what he did to try to get some extra cash, or just simply because he was nice and just did it for people. It was a way for him, as a guy who was disabled, worked under the counter in timber and things like that, so he didn't have a huge Social Security check. That was his way to be a man, right? And to also with only $260 a month on lot rent. So that's another story I talk about. Rural masculinity, you know, it's tough being a man in rural America. And another aspect, I'm almost done. I really went over time. I told you, we like to gab. I really like to gab. I'm really too good at it. The element that I also try to highlight is not just how this was a functional community. In many communities, we need to look under the surface and not be distracted by things that look like trash, right? One person's trash is another person's treasure, right? Is to remind ourselves of those kinds of realities in the world. But there were lots of ways that this community raised its voice. And it wasn't just me. The reason I knew that there was an issue at Syringa in March 2015 wasn't because I was just so astute. It was because this community called the commissioners and asked them to have a meeting out at their recreation center because they were pissed about the red tags. Now, that is called social movement organizing, because that is one of the things you do, is you send out a press release that something's going to happen and you let people know. And I remember Dawn and Shannon talking about when they had figured out that they were going to call the newspapers. to let them know about the red tags and then to also get the commissioners out. And they said, you know, and Don had learned some of this from the Women's Center too, right, is that, well, we need to get in touch with the newspapers, but I don't have time. And Shannon said, well, what's the number? And so Don looked it up and Shannon called, and that is the day that they started mobilizing using the media to help them. So I do spend a little bit of time talking about what do people do when they have few resources? How do they mobilize? You know, I am one piece of that, but as Don said, I was strategic, right? So I want this also be understood as a way for affluent people to understand that poor people have brains and know how to do things, you know, but also as a handbook for people who feel helpless to know that these are some of the ways that you can level up your voice, right? So that's another element, and I'm going to whiz through here. And then the lessons. And some of the lessons, unfortunately, right after I finished this book, I concluded with things like, oh, there's land trusts that we can try to pursue. Oh, and there's these things called cooperatives. The chapter starts with how Shannon and Don and I met in April 2017 before the closure announcement, talking about the dream of forming a cooperative where the residents would own it and what it would look like. You know, Shannon and Don were both talking about community gardens and that we'd build an orchard and we'd do some things that would draw the public in. We'd treat it like it's a real park so that people who aren't part of our community would see us as human beings. So there were all these visions that they had. And cooperatives were definitely part of that story. I also get on a tangent about rent control at the federal level, please. So those kinds of dreams. Yes, dreams, but we all have to aim high to at least get somewhere, don't we? So Kathy is laughing inside. Yes, yes, all these things. So there are these kinds of lessons that we draw, and unfortunately, we need to dig deep into these lessons because we have many mobile home communities in this county, not just in Moscow, that are bought up by at least one corporation that are raising rents up to $525, $550 per lot compared to $260, right? And one park, Robinson, might be jacked up to $775. So we have to read this book not only to get money to Sojourners, because Sojourner needs money all the time, but we also need to think about what are we going to do to put pressure on our legislators to protect our communities, because I think Idaho identifies very strongly with the people represented in this book and their stories. And they like the idea of the 60s and working class utopian communities, but we haven't done a good job making sure that they're available to everyone. So that's how I end. One more slide, just as a thanks. Thank you, all the people in tiny print on here. And it's not everyone, but these are some of the leaders that I would like to acknowledge. And thank you so much.
That was Leontina Hormel. She's a University of Idaho sociology professor, and she held a launch event Tuesday for her new book, Trailer Park America, Reimagining Working Class Communities. And you're listening to the KRFP Evening Report on KRFP Moscow Pullman. We'll continue with the book launch event recorded on Tuesday by KRFP citizen journalist Brenda Cox in just a moment.
Love's Kombucha is proud to support KRFP Radio Free Moscow. Love's Kombucha is a fun, lively, fermented probiotic tea that is craft brewed right here in Moscow. For more information, visit loveskombucha.com.
From here, I wanted to
end at around 7:30, just so that if people want a signed book, not making any assumptions here, but if you want a signed book, I wanted to make sure there was time so that we can close up everything by 8 p.m. and people can get out of here and actually put their feet up for a bit, right? So are there any questions or comments that people have before wrapping up by 7:30? Yeah.
This
farm where they sold the trailer park to the
responsible owner?
Yeah.
Do they know about any of the water issues when they bought it?
So it did Lagarde or?
Yeah.
I would doubt he cared. but I don't know if he did. Representing an individual? Yeah. So there definitely are attorneys that are aware of this, and there have been lots of education letters sent out with no responses. But nonetheless, we got over 51% of four communities. That's Appaloosa Court, Abiel, Palouse Hills, and Woodland Heights. Over 51% signed off and said, yes, we want to be represented by a cooperative. The minute that that was formed, and it's Victoria O'Banion, who is the Northwest Cooperative Development Center coordinator. She has helped us a lot in this. Kathy LaFortune, founder for us. And so she has been helping us, and she sent a letter the minute they signed off as officers. She sent a letter immediately to Hurst & Son, which is the corporation that owns these parks, and said, when you intend to sell any one of these parks, the residents of that park would like to know first so that we can own the land. Thank you. So at least that's in place. You know, there's lots of loopholes. Yeah.
The city know anyone who lives in any of the six parks around here, that they get an eviction notice, please have them call the Intermountain
Fair Housing Council. Yes.
They are all prepared to represent each one of the individuals with that notice.
Yes. Yep. And Evergreen is a new one, and Bluebird is another new one to add to those four parks. Kathy, have a comment?
I just wanted to say that one of the things we're trying to work on is right now what happens with those 106 mobile home parks is those sold without anybody ever knowing. Well, they never hit the market. And in Idaho, you don't have to notify anyone to hit the market. So we're trying just a small tweak of legislation at the state level so that because there's a statute now that says if it hits the market and the community is organized, then they have to give the community a chance to purchase, to make an offer at least. And what we're trying to do is change that legislation to say if there is intent to sell, which is a big difference.
Yes.
What happened here is there was another owner.
Yes.
The state corporation came in, made an offer, he couldn't refuse. The next day the papers were signed and he was gone. And so we want to make sure that the folks in the community have enough chance to organize and we can offer.
And they own over 70 mobile home communities in Washington State alone. And one of those in Puyallup was bought for $7 million. So they're offering a lot of money. Their reason they're able to convince people to sell, even if they weren't thinking of selling, is that it's understood that they're offering over market value to do so.
Our parks were all purchased before we ever knew anything. And next thing you know, we were told, oh, we're the new owner now. There's, you know, we want really.
Yes, and the practices that are going on, especially in Appaloosa and Woodland Heights, in reading this book, you know, Susie over in Woodland Heights says, these sound so familiar. What Syringa folks went through is exactly what these people are doing to us, right? And what's really interesting is that even in the places that have access to municipal water and sewage, their water was turned off once at Abiel without any notification. It's just one switch, and all of their water can be turned off. So it's like a little kingdom, right? A little feudal system where they're there, and it's if the lord of the manor is happy, you get to have water and stuff. But if not, there are these things that they legally can do. It's very hard to fine even. You can't even find them, really. Yeah.
Can they legally do them, or they just aren't going to get caught for breaking the law?
Yeah. Generally, what happened out at Syringa was that, and Michael Kameen, who I interviewed three different times, he was so patient. It's like, I need to understand this more. Michael, can I meet again? And but he said, you know, all you can do if you're Idaho DEQ is just say, we would really like you to comply. Here's what you should do, you know, and they might warn them and try to go above their head eventually with the Attorney General of the state, but even that doesn't have a lot of teeth, and I don't think it would have much right now at all. So
when our current governor, and I do appreciate a lot of his work, but he always opens up his speeches. Idaho is the most deregulated state.
It doesn't work. I mean, this is where the real downfall of deregulation hits.
You know, could you send them a copy of your book?
I will. That's a really great idea. I was like, oh yeah, I could send this to the governor.
Cutting down shade trees is another example.
Yes, cutting down shade trees. That was a big one that was featured in the latest Northwest public broadcasting report was just taking down trees that were for shade. And if we look at studies in mobile home parks or manufactured home parks, or what we might want to call factory-built home communities. Yes, exactly. Is that those homes are really, really hot, you know, very little insulation, so they're super hot in the summer, and they cut down a bunch of shade trees without any indication. That's what this latest corporation did, including trees where there were baby birds, one tree that was very sentimental that had the children swing in it, and a whole generation of kids used to enjoy that tree. So there have definitely been... there's been backlash and retaliation that the attorneys are calling retaliation since this cooperative was built. And I just want to say, like, Syringa has been a great lesson. And that is one thing. When people are going through these things, Syringa comes up a lot, especially when Appaloosa was going through the worst of the sewage and water issues. Syringa is a legend. And Syringa has been informing people's minds, both everyday people on the ground in these communities, but also, I know for a fact, has affected county, city, and I hope more, leaders in the state. So, Don, is there anyone else, Trapper, anyone else from Syringa that's here? Great. Thank you. Oh, I know these people. You're getting a book. Right on. Welcome. So you all gave us lessons to work on.
We lived in Syringa in 79, and, you know, the swimming pool was there. We took our little girl over there. It was wonderful then.
Yeah,
great.
Didn't we? Yeah. Yes, I got out to interview you. You and I talked about the wetland. And that it probably shouldn't have been built there.
Sorry.
Yep.
Do you have books still?
Yeah. Yes. Oh, do we have books still?
No.
Are we out?
Carol.
Are we out of books?
We are, but I'm taking four to the next one.
Okay. Right. Excellent.
I'm looking forward right now.
What's the status of the park and the owner?
For Syringa?
Yeah.
Well, I can say that Phil Reinhardt owns it now. He's decommissioned the sewage lagoons. I interviewed him during COVID time. and so he's decommissioned the sewage lagoons. That's completely now okay. And he is steadily deconstructing the park. He's hiring guys who don't come with many skills, and he's testing them out by having them slowly empty out the park and decommissioning homes. So I asked him what his vision is, and he said, well, other than keeping some of the really beautiful trees and bushes and things that people took care of, he had no certainty of what he was going to do with it. But it's going to be slow because he's not in a hurry. Yeah.
I was just saying, we've gone back and forth between having, you know, have hauling what, so they've taken all of the valuable stuff out of what's remaining of the shells, and there's no more copper, there's no more copper wire anywhere, so you're going to leave that, but any of the other valuable stuff could be recycled, all of those types of things have been removed, and then what's left to do is basically, you know, to crush what's remaining, and he's gone back and forth between, you know, hauling them to the landfill and having them crushed there, versus it's probably more economical for him to just do this crushing right on site.
Mm-hmm.
And so figuring out a good site in a wetlands.
Yeah.
Is this work and get out of the suspension?
And he did say that he's thinking of keeping the rec center because it's such a solid structure. But it all depends on what he ends up doing.
You better look at the plumbing in the pool.
Oh, he's not using the pool. That goes out. That's being taken out, but the rest of that structure is great.
The furnace as well.
Yeah.
You talked about writing the first refusal, and Kathy mentioned this, you know, maybe a time clock ticking with the intent to sell. Do you know what period of time is wherein the residents would have a chance to organize and earn the money or whatever?
I have to pull up the statute.
I think it was something
ridiculously
short, like 30 days.
I think it is.
Yeah, $7 million in 30 days.
Yeah.
Push, right?
But that's what, by these folks organizing, mm-hmm. they're now hooked in with Victoria O'Fanlon from, it's called Resident Home Communities, Rocks USA, mm-hmm. and they will actually help cooperatives finance these type of purchases.
Yeah.
You know, she's very upfront. She's like, you know, this is not going to like reduce your lot there. You know, if anything, it will go off because they finance it more than the parking first with the idea that you need to have a cushion in there to make sure that you do the improvements, etc. And she said, you know, all of the good things about owning your own place are also go along with all of the things that we don't necessarily like about a property. Like, if you're in part of a property, you could just say, your homeowners association rules and regulations. And, you know, you may have an argument with your neighbor about what those rules and regulations are, but if you're not willing to spend time to sit on the board, then probably your neighbor who is going to get their rules and regulations.
I like the color pink.
The homeowners association is like, I don't want to be able to paint my trailer whatever color I want to paint it. Maybe not. I'll have to do so.
Yep.
So there's good and bads of organizing, but I mean, this community, they see the benefits of building equity, of being able to have a stable place to live. All of the stuff people is going to really fun.
So.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
You've been listening to a book launch held this past Tuesday at the 1912 Center with University of Idaho Sociology Professor Leontina Hormel. And you also heard from members of the audience and former Syringa Mobile Home Park resident Don Tichel. The book is called Trailer Park America, Reimagining Working Class Communities. All royalties for the sale of the book will go to the local group dealing with homelessness and housing issues, Sojourners Alliance, who has been in the community for a number of years. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report, special Friday edition for tonight. Taking a look at the weather, mostly sunny tomorrow, high 49, 90% chance of rain Saturday night. Rain after 10 p.m., mixing with snow after 4 a.m., little or no snow accumulation expected, low 35. On Sunday, 70% chance of precipitation, rain and snow likely before 10 a.m., then a chance of rain, little or no snow accumulation expected, snow level 3,600 feet, mostly cloudy, high 44, and breezy, west winds 15 to 20 with gusts up to 30. Mostly cloudy Sunday night, low 28, and mostly sunny on Monday, high 45. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. You can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business supports community radio. You can also adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option and a Patreon button as well. Once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. I'm Lee Robartis. Jim Roach and Brenda Cox assisted with tonight's newscast. Stand by for more. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman.
KRFP is supported by listeners like you and by Moscow Ale House, with something for everyone in the family. You can find Moscow Ale House at 226 West 6th Street or call 208-882-BREW. That's 208-882-2739.
Don't touch that dial. You got it right.
We're up in the morning when it first gets light, and we do it all day. Then we're up all night so you can listen to the radio.
You got it right.
Listen to the radio. You got it right.